Informed and unspun. This is The Big Picture.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to The Big Picture, your weekly dose of all things political. I am your host for this week, Kieran Merchandani-Cooper. On tonight's show, we'll be discussing last week's debate between Nigel Farage and Nick Clegg, and we'll be giving some insight in what we hope to see from the leaders' debate tonight. Yes, two debates between Farage and Clegg in 2 weeks. Considering how popular they are, here's hoping they get themselves a primetime Saturday night show. We'll also be discussing the outcome of the recent French election and considering its impact, not just for the nation, but for Europe and the wider world. And we'll also be talking about the latest controversy to engulf the government. But more of that later. For now, let's go on and introduce tonight's panel.
Luke, second year law with American law student.
Hey, good evening, I'm David Hayes. I'm a PhD student reading criminal justice.
Seb Bench, second year politics student.
I'm Matt, I'm doing politics and American studies here.
And Joseph Hemsworth, first year history student.
Great. Now, don't forget, we love to hear from you here on The Big Picture. If you have any views on what we're going to be saying throughout the show today, don't forget, you can send us in a free web text through the website urn1350.net, or you can send us one via your phone, 07762 212 434, or tweet us at urn1350. Now, over the last few years, one man has come to define and dictate much of British politics. The man is not a member of Parliament and belongs to a party that has no elected representative in the House of Commons, and yet he manages to set the agenda week after week. That man is Nigel Farage, whose EU-bashing, bureaucracy-hating, cigarette-loving persona has chimed with sways of the British public to the extent that he and UKIP are seen as a genuine threat to the three major parties by some. As a result, Nick Clegg agreed to a head-to-head debate with him to discuss immigration, one last week and one being broadcast tonight on the BBC. Whilst the general consensus amongst politicos was that Clegg won the Westminster vote, whilst Farage won the country's vote regarding the debate, what do our panel think of how last week's debate went? Luke?
Well, I don't think it changed much in terms of the fact that actually a lot of people who probably look into the issues of the EU see that it's not as black and white as Nigel Farage would like it to be, and they see that there's actually a lot more depth to it. And that's not me saying that what Nick Clegg said in every instance there was correct, because there were bits that I disagree with him on, and that I think a lot of people disagreed with him on. But when we've got such a polarised debate as Nigel Farage saying, let's get out, all these things are bad, and Clegg saying, let's stay in, all these things are good, we're better off, it's very difficult. And I think really the majority of the people probably sit somewhere in that middle ground. Nigel Farage has attracted all the people to whom he has always been appealing, and likewise for Nick Clegg.
I mean, I kind of disagree. I kind of think that the polarization is a good thing because it makes people think. I think that most people will have said, well, actually, I didn't know this about the EU, or I didn't consider this before. And I think so it's good that you've got two polarizing figures in that sense. I mean, the thing about Nigel Farage is he's populist. He's quite exciting. I mean, I think if his persona and personality wasn't there, I don't think UKIP would have had such a high profile. And indeed, if he does go and stand down, if he doesn't win a seat in Parliament in 2015, then I think UKIP may actually decline somewhat. But I think the debate was good. I think it dispelled some myths. I think Clegg was quite good at doing that. But I mean, in other senses, Farage did dominate with his personality and some sort of, you know, rhetoric that seemed to chime with some of the audience. I mean, the early exit polls said that Farage won by a narrow margin. Well, we can't obviously measure that very much. We don't know whether it's true or not. But I would like to think also that people would actually see Farage for what he is, which, you know, is irrational. His arguments don't stand up. So I hope it gets a debate going and the discussion becomes more enriched. And that's what the debate did.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think I can definitely see Farage coming out on top here because it's a format that to which he's ideally suited. I mean, you look at the way that Clegg changed his tune over the course of the hour in terms of interrupting more, being more standoffish, because he's no longer in sort of an Eton debating hall or something like that. And Clegg didn't go to Eton, you know, whichever one he ended up in. The point I'm trying to make is that I'm not sure that this is even the right theatre for him and his party to try and really contest the Nigel Farage and UKIP's claims, because Nigel Farage is a demagogue, plain and simple. He's someone who is very good at whipping up public sentiment, and that kind of demagoguery can only really be defeated with a very well-reasoned, very logical, very rational, and very publicly accessible argument. Now, a public debate is very accessible, but it's very difficult to be rational and comprehensive in your arguments. So I think, yeah, this is somewhere which wasn't really so much about who was in the right, but I think it was more more about Nick Clegg trying to woo back people who have felt disaffected with him ever since the 2010 coalition agreement, and Nigel Farage trying to score even more political attention.
I want to bring it back to the idea of Nigel Farage and the demigod thing. And actually, if you think about UKIP, many people just consider it a one man band, basically.
A one white male man band.
Yes, yes. And what I want to know is, do people think that, I mean, Nigel Farage arguably can hold up to the scrutiny of the press. Do you think the rest of the party, as we come into election season, are going to be able to hold up to the scrutiny of the press in the same way that Farage does? I mean, someone like, you know, Godfrey Jones, who I know has left the party, but that
Bloom.
Would be a great example.
Godfrey Bloom.
Bloom, sorry, yeah. Who left the party, but that would be a good example.
No, I don't think they will. I think everything really hangs on Farage, and I think other people are right in suggesting that once he's left, you know, what's going to happen to the party? Because he's literally holding everything together. He is this very public, open, loud sort of populist figure. I mean, I wouldn't go as far as David in saying he's a demagogue, but he's certainly got shades of that, certainly. And, you know, I think he knows what he's doing. He does, but I think the problem is in getting the party in order and actually providing some discipline. And, you know, they talk about how they're sort of restructuring the manifesto and what have you, but if they're not restructuring discipline and actually getting their, you know, people in order, then they're going to suffer greatly.
I think it's clear Nigel Farage is a very able communicator, and I think it is fair to say, in effect, UKIP, at least in the eyes of the majority of the public, are a one-man band. I mean, people recognise Nigel Farage. You know, but I wonder, you know, how many of the rest of the country, you know, recognises Paul Nuttall, their deputy leader, or Diane James, who was their candidate in Eastleigh, who came second. I think their recognition really greatly tails off after Nigel Farage, and I think that's going to be a huge problem in individual constituencies, because we've seen, well, both Godfrey Bloom and, you know, countless other councillors and members of UKIP say very controversial things. And if they haven't vetted well enough, that's going to come up very clearly in each individual constituency and is going to hurt them there.
Luke?
Well, I've been a bit more reserved than I usually am on UKIP, and I think probably I've unleashed before, and I've just thought, I've literally sat down, so you can't see this, but I'm in the studio, I've sat down because I want to be a bit calmer. But the truth is that UKIP are a joke as a party. They're built on the fact that they are able to tap in to a sense of public unawareness with certain elements of politics, like the EU. People don't fully know what is happening with the EU. I don't fully know what's happening with the EU, and I'm meant to be studying a thing as part of law. So people don't fully know. So they're able to hear the sound bites that Farage presents, and that is enough for them. And it's the same with so many other issues. And actually, the truth is that the more scrutiny there is, and as David said, in the right kind of environment, that's only going to mean it's going to be worse for Nigel Farage. At the moment, he's benefiting from the fact that he can say things and they've been kind of going unchallenged. I don't think the way that this debate has been done is the best way to actually challenge them in a way that's going to get through to the public. But I do think there needs to be more of this challenge, because at the moment, as I say, from the names that we've heard so far, whether it's Gordon whatever down in the south that tried to suggest that children in care were scroungers from the system, he was a member of UKIP, whether it was the person who said that there was something to do with, I don't have stolen Matt's point there, I do apologise Matt, whether it's the person who claimed that the floods were a result of gay marriage, you know, this is a party that actually attracts the kind of people that should not be a part of a political party.
I agree. I think I kind of feel that Clegg was sort of in Farage's arena, if you like. He was sort of in his comfort zone in this sort of debate. But I think that the political capital that he's going to make out of it will be short-lived. For the example you've just given, I mean, that was in southeast Cambridgeshire where I live. So I think when people actually look at the party's policies, I mean, their manifesto is just... I'm not even going to go into their manifesto because it's just... it's terrible. But I think the debate tonight will... perhaps step up a gear. I think Clegg might actually up his game slightly or realise his mistakes from the first debate. I kind of feel this is personal to him, but also I agree with David that he's going after the wrong issue, really. And again, people need to look into the EU more. I mean, Nick Clegg brought up the numbers of Romanians and the leaflets that UKIP was circulating around areas. But, you know, for example, immigrants, they pay 34% more tax than British citizens, you know. So this needs to be looked into, and I hope Clegg tries to dispel some of the myths that Farage is undoubtedly going to spew. But yeah, I think the capital will be short-lived.
David?
I think a lot depends on how big UKIP's lunatic fringe is, because every party does have a lunatic fringe. And UKIP, as we've seen from exactly the sorts of things that Luke and Matt have been talking about, is no exception as a political party. And it remains to be seen whether the press have managed to exhaust that or not. In terms of one-person parties as well, I think in all fairness, that's true of a lot of smaller and up-and-coming parties. I mean, look at the Greens. For a long time, the only Green that people knew was Carolyn Lucas, and I think that's still the case for a vast number of people. Just having one central figurehead who dominates the figures isn't necessarily a bad thing. Nigel Farage is not necessarily Robert Kilroy Silk.
A blast from the past.
Well, there you go. I have been in this business 7 years, would you believe? The point I'm trying to make is that in many respects, this, and that's another failing of this debate in a way, is that it does pit Farage against Clegg, one party against another, when of course the situation is much more diverse. And the Liberal Democrats are trying to contend on this and say that Nick Clegg is the only person who has stepped up and the only person who's willing to take Farage up on his bile and nonsense. And to a certain extent that's true, because he's the only person who physically has in this particular form. But he's done that in a form which has frozen out the Greens, which has frozen out Labour, which has even frozen out the Conservatives. And it remains to be seen how long that sort of debate remains tenable.
Okay, I want to talk about a bit about Nigel Farage's policy. There was a documentary on Channel 4 this week which followed Farage through the EU. It was quite entertaining, gave him quite a lot of free time. It gave him, wasn't very critical. The only area where it was critical was on immigration and his immigration policy, which I think is where he gets stuck a lot of the time. The idea that you have to, if you want to come and work in England, you have to have proof of work at the immigration desk, and plus you're not allowed access to welfare, education, health for 5 years after joining this. What do people think of his immigration policy as a reflection of UKIP as a party? Joe?
I haven't a clue what it is. I mean, I'm in favour of managed migration, and you know, people might lump me in with UKIP. I don't know. That's up to other people. But you know, in all honesty, and it's what other people have touched on as well, there's yet to be a sort of clear, coherent, cogent set out plan for what UKIP stands for, apart from the basic points of out of the EU, sort of fairly laissez-faire capitalism, etc., etc. So, I haven't a clue, to be honest.
I think it's a very poor immigration policy, but I suppose it's what you'd expect. I think you said in reference to UKIP, I suppose it may even be moderate compared to some of UKIP's members. First, it said the idea, we've got to remember, a lot of the people, immigrants, won't necessarily be working in very high power jobs. So maybe when they do get jobs, but they may need, say, benefits the way many Britons do to actually bring even their full-time income up to a livable level. And we've also got to remember there's the possibility for anyone immigrant or Briton to things to go wrong within 5 years. They could have a very good job when they come here, but then that fall through, and or even, you know, get ill, very ill, not be able to afford to pay for that, and you know, maybe not be rich enough if they have kids to put them through a private education. So I think it's incredibly kind of stingy immigration policy. It almost says okay, you can, you know, stand in our land, you can breathe our air, but nothing else. And it obviously ignores the major point, which I think Dems have been right to say, that actually immigration can produce great benefits. I think Vince Cable has in particular. Matt, you mentioned actually they contribute far more in tax revenue than they take out in benefits. So that's not a worry. And they cover great skill shortages in the UK economy and actually create jobs by a huge amounts of immigrants who start up businesses and employ other immigrant and British workers. So to claim that's all bad and put these limits, I think, is a misguided and extremely populist immigration policy.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, the 2010 manifesto was very weak and very vague. I mean, one of their education policy was essentially to teach more English history in schools. It wasn't anything comprehensive. And like the panel has said, I mean, the immigration policy is so one-dimensional. I mean, anyone who watched Benefit Street, the immigrants who are on the same street weren't exactly living a life of luxury. None of them used the welfare system or the health service, as far as I know. But I think it just they demonize immigrants, perfectly working people who work very hard. And I think it's a real shame, because actually it warps the debate. But I think that UKIP, they're an outlet for people who are frustrated with the status quo. They simply see no alternative, or they see the main parties as being very similar. And I mean, I went out knocking on doors campaigning a couple of months ago, and one guy who I spoke to said he's voting for UKIP because there are too many food banks in the UK. I mean, I didn't really know what to say to him. But I mean, it's that sort of frustration with sort of a rugged individualism and against the state that people sort of like, and they're anti-immigration as well, so they're an outlet, but I think that UKIP will be short-lived in terms of political capital.
The only thing I'd say in response to that is I think that UKIP's immigration policy says less about UKIP as a party than it does about the immigration debate as a whole, which has been so profoundly middle of the road, chasing middle England, chasing the single dominant message, chasing such a similar arrangement in the immigration policy between all three parties, which is, you know, we must control, we must limit, we must destroy. Well, not destroy, but you know what I mean. We must reduce the amount of people coming into this country, which allows this kind of petty Eurosceptic demagoguery to breed and to thrive. And I think really that's the problem. And it's been said well by I think this was on the Left Foot Forward blog that you know, if we take Nick Clegg as the most outspoken person in favor of immigration, and after the EU debates he probably is amongst the three major parties, he's defending it purely on economic grounds in terms of this is more jobs, this is more money coming in, this is more people doing the sorts of jobs that people around, the native workers tend to turn their nose up at. And I think it's profoundly disturbing that we have lost sight of the fact, as someone who's practically an immigrant in this country myself, that we have lost sight of the fact that immigration enriches our culture, that we are a nation of successive waves of migration, and that we have gained something valuable, something intrinsic, something non-fungible from people coming into this country.
I completely agree with David, and I think it's really important that Farage focuses on the economic arguments, because there is a cultural nationalism there that is actually quite dangerous. I don't think it's what Britain needs. I mean, in light of multiculturalism has done brought, you know, a vast amount of benefits to this country. I think it's really important to focus on all sides of the debate.
Great. And one question, if we could keep our answers brief, please. I mean, how much of a threat do you think Farage will be at the next election? Luke?
Well, there are going to be very few people, i.e. only a maximum of one constituency, that are going to be voting for Nigel Farage anyway. So in that respect, I think even wherever Farage stands, he's probably not going to personally win. And, you know, that's the only chance UKIP have really got of getting anybody in. I think in the other areas, particularly those areas that have had UKIP before, I know Lincolnshire had a UKIP administration on the council. They've seen what UKIP do. They've seen that they're not a real party to lead, and I don't think those sort of places are going to be voting for them anymore either.
Seb?
Their major impact and danger will be how they affect races between other parties. They're not going to win many seats in Parliament, and so they're not going to be the great, influential, big UKIP revolution in Westminster that they hope they'll be.
Yeah, echo the comments, really. I think they're going to be very short-lived. I think it's going to be an exciting debate, sort of make it varied, but I think when it actually comes down to numbers, the actual chances, the probabilities, not very high.
Yeah, I don't think they'll win anything. I think they'll influence the debate to a certain extent, as they are now, in the sense of provoking some sort of an argument, but it's not really going to be something outstanding. And I think in the end, they are going to decline out of a sense of inevitability, really. You look at the people who are voting for them, and such like. So it's not just dependent on the arguments, it's dependent on people as well.
Now, to France, and the cheese-eating surrender monkeys have only gone and elected a new prime minister.
I'm sorry.
too far. Manuel Valls, who positions himself on the right of the Socialist Party in France, has openly projected himself as an heir to Blair and has been described as a reformist, pro-growth social democrat, not afraid to take on the vested interests and challenge conventional status thinking in France. Despite this, the character of his cabinet is not defined in such a way. The new economics minister, Arnaud Montebourg, comes from the left of the party.
And I'm sorry.
I'm trying to be, you know, I'm trying to do it in a fun way. Has pushed an anti-globalist agenda, including encouraging economic patriotism, leading to The Economist calling him the socialist Sarkozy. So, do the panel believe that in France, a new dawn has risen, to paraphrase Blair? David?
I wouldn't go that far. I think these election results reflect a lot of different things. I mean, the Prime Minister has said that he's going to take the blame for the socialist losses, which is a very prime minister thing to do in French politics. Mm-hmm. But I think this is much more about François Hollande and his work as president, the failures of his regime and the failures to live up to all the hype and all the promise of the post-Sarkozy era. And so I see it as more as a result of that, a result of rising Euroscepticism within France and a willingness to be more right-wing in local elections, similar to the way we are here in the UK. So I think it's a range of different things, and I think it's more consistency than it is change.
We've got a new panelist with us, Bharathi. Thank you very much for joining us.
Yes.
What do you think?
It's not a new dawn, because in France there's never a new dawn when it comes to politics. Things in France change even slower than they do over here, because in France you sort of only have two parties, and then, okay, you kind of have Le Front National now. Just before we look on to what Manuel Valls is up to, just a couple of notes about the elections. Yes, there were heavy losses for the socialists, but you've got to bear in mind that in France there are only three parties. You've got the UMP, the socialists, and the National Front. And so if you're discontented, if you're not happy with what the socialists are doing, you're obviously going to vote for the right. And the problem with the right is the UMP is in crisis right now because it doesn't have any form of solid leadership. So who do you turn to? By default, you kind of get pushed into the National Front bucket. Also, the other thing to remember is that in the previous local elections, and the ones before these, the UMP had an absolute cauchemar, as the French would say, an absolute nightmare, in that they lost control of every single region except Alsace. And that was shockingly poor. But what it meant was that the socialists were in charge of a lot of regions that they couldn't hope to hold if they ever got into power, because that's just the nature of French politics itself. The fact is, as France, like this country, has sort of regional support. So if you're in the south or you're in a really particularly student area, you'll probably vote for the left. And if you don't, you'll vote for the right. That's a general rule. So I don't think you can read too much into this. That's why I wouldn't say that Manuel Valls is the herald of a new dawn.
Okay, so let's talk about this in regards to Europe. How do we think that his election as prime minister, it will affect the European political landscape, if at all? Anybody? David?
I think it reflects more of the same. Again, it reflects Hollande trying to stabilise his position in terms of public opinion by getting somebody who's further to the right than he himself. But as you said in the lead-in, there are a lot of old dyed-in-the-wool socialists there in the cabinet. And it remains to be seen. I mean, in terms of their policy in terms of deficit reduction, in terms of following the very strict requirements that have been laid down on them by the European Commission and by Brussels in general. I think what we are going to see more of the same, more of Hollande trying to crack through the Merkel-Sarkozy austerity orthodoxy and try and bring a new left-wing spending-led approach. I don't think it's going to be phenomenally successful, but I don't think this is any kind of new and exciting world for them either.
Luke?
I think to an extent, and I do feel thoroughly unqualified to speak in this because my knowledge of French politics is very limited, and obviously Bharathi and David have both said some very thoughtful things so far. But as far as, I suppose, an outsider observation goes, I would hope and I think what could happen is Hollande, who has come in as representing something very different to the Sarkozy and Merkel orthodoxy, as David mentioned, is perhaps going to scale back because, without it sounding cliche, you know, socialism hasn't worked in France now. It's been shown that what Hollande has been trying to do, he's continued to sort of distance himself from. He's come in with his vision or whatever, and it's not worked as far as France's economic situation's gone. So he's kind of moved back and done a few things that I think people wouldn't have expected him to have done. And I think this election of a prime minister, of a different prime minister rather, is going to mean that from Hollande's point of view, he's going to need to continue to scale that back, because this is a vote of no confidence in the left-wing socialism that I think Hollande would ideologically want to move forward, and it might mean that he's going to have to rethink things.
Bharathi?
In short, I don't think it's really going to change much. I do pity Hollande in the sense that, yes, there is this Sarkozy-Merkel orthodoxy, but a lot of this was decided before he was even in power as president. So he's kind of fighting against that which has already been decided, which is a lot harder when you're in Europe or when you're in politics in general. In terms of... Well, I said no. I mean, I guess you will try and see Hollande trying to bring some element of socialism towards Europe's economic policy. Whether he will or not remains up to his own. I mean, in terms of France itself, I mean, constitutionally, the position of the president, the relationship between president and prime minister is, it's interesting because it's often said that the president takes all, reaps the rewards for anything good that happens, and it's the prime minister has to take the fall. So I find it slightly interesting that he's gone for someone on who's slightly more right-wing. Well, I'd say that in the looser sense of the word. Right-wing as his prime minister to take the fall, but there you are.
Jay?
I'm in the same box as Luke, really. I'm, you know, very inexperienced knowledge-wise when it comes to French politics, but sort of thinking on what other people have said, yeah, it doesn't seem from my perspective, which again is a fairly inexperienced one, that it's going to affect European politics a great deal. From what I've heard news-wise and from these chaps as well, it seems more domestic.
Yes, David.
Well, in terms, perhaps, I suppose, partly as a riposte to Luke in terms of socialism failing in France, I think it's very difficult, isn't it, to ever compare two countries' political systems, because France are radically more left-wing than the UK in a lot of ways, but radically more right-wing in a lot of other ways. But generally speaking, social democracy has been far more embraced there on a cultural level, has been far more recognised than the UK, where a more liberal market capitalism is seen as the political status quo ante. And so from that perspective, I think it's easier to see this as a blip, as a protest vote in a comparatively minor election. And to that extent, yeah, I don't think it's going to change massively France's direction either within Europe or outside of it.
I mean, Hollande came in on a kind of a very socialist campaign, a promise of to enforce socialism within the government of France. Do you think he's been successful in doing that?
No, poor François. It's it has been phenomenally difficult for him. He's what Obama could have been, and I make that statement inadvisably because, again, you can't compare Obama and Hollande, even though they're both more or less left-wing figures within their own country's systems. But it's just been a phenomenally bad few years for him. Ever since replacing Sarkozy, unemployment has rocketed. They've had foreign policy disasters, well, with all sorts of difficulties. They've been rocked by personal scandals, which is difficult because it's always the right wing that has a monopoly on sleaze. Or not a monopoly, but at least in a market in very uneven conditions. But in any event, yeah. I don't think he's been very successful at all. And yeah, I think partly you can see the most recent election results as a recognition of that fact.
Like I already said, I don't think you can read as much into the election results as I'm sure Le Monde is making it out to be. In terms of has socialism, what difference? I think we've seen from a social perspective, at least when it comes to social policy, economics aside, yeah, there have been changes in France, you know, especially with gay marriage. It was one of his big campaign pledges. It's one of the ones that got a lot of attention because Sarkozy was explicitly against it. Economically, there's a lot that he considered. But I mean, it's not too late for him because he's only halfway through his election term, which seems incredible because it feels like he's been around forever, but he's only halfway through. So, I mean, there's still hope for him. Yeah.
Luke.
Well, again, I'm going to show my intelligence by bringing reference to a very amusing BuzzFeed article, actually, which is 15 pictures of François Hollande trying to shake hands with other foreign leaders and basically them just ignoring him. And I guess that's my contribution, which is probably more worthwhile than any intelligent point I'd try to make. So do check it out. But just to say, you know, as David said, the statistics show that one of the promises that he made was he was going to make sure that unemployment was falling by the end of 2013, and you know it didn't, and he's still not got a coherent strategy that's got any kind of legitimacy behind it in order to try and improve the economic situation. And I think as long as that is the case, then he's going to go down as a failing president.
From my perspective, I mean, people have talked about the economics of it, and you know the general consensus seems to be that he's been a failure. But from a sort of general interest about foreign policy, actually, I thought it was interesting with Hollande and sort of intrusion into North Africa, and you can take Mali, for example, and what that sort of showed of this new face of France. And it doesn't seem to have come to much, whether you're a sort of neocon or not. That sort of intrusiveness doesn't seem to have evolved into anything. and it seems to be, well, sort of same old France.
Just like to point, you have to look at the circumstances in which Hollande was elected. He came on the bat after three presidential terms of it being the UMP and the right. So obviously, well, I think I can't say obviously because I can't read into the minds of the French people as much as I like to try. Inevitably, I think we can say some of his support will have been just, it's a reaction against the right and the amount of sleaze that has come out of the right French right wing. And they do have a monopoly on sleaze. Over the last couple of decades, ever since Mitterrand finished his second term, we've had a lot of issues. You know, we've had nepotism, donation scandals, all sorts. So that's part of it. And I think the downside of that is that I don't think the people were quite ready for socialism and quite as ready to embrace what a socialist ideal was, rather than just a rejection of what the status quo was at that time. And I forgot what I was going to say now.
Well, maybe if I can just leap in while we're in the spirit of referencing social media and things. I saw an interesting, and this goes back to Joe's point as well, I saw an interesting cartoon from, I believe, a Nigerian cartoonist, which criticised Hollande for his intervention in Mali, where it said, France has the right to interfere in African nation states' territoriality, but not my privacy, relating to the allegations that rose, well, I say allegations, the proof of his... of his infidelity. And I think that's, whilst that's obviously being very flippant, I think it does reflect that there's a general malaise, a sense of indirection in Sarkozy's government, a sense of him having one hand tied behind his back by the European austerity drive. And I think that's, as much as anything, driving the success of the Front National and its petty-minded, again, demagoguery.
Barathi, the final word?
Two quick points. First of all, regarding the Mali intervention, I think it's important to remember that the government of Mali asked for France's help. France didn't just go in off its own accord and do what it did. The other thing, I think the problem that the left have, and it's the problem that the right's having now, is just having a strong personality, because France is very much, especially on a national level, personality-led politics. And I think in the future, this is what all parties are going to have to look to.
Now, on to our final issue of debate tonight. The Justice Secretary has been defending his policy regarding books being sent to prisons after Caroline Duffy, the poet laureate, can't get my words out, said it was hurting the soul of the country. This regards Christopher Grayling's decision to stop parcels being allowed to be sent into prisons for prisoners due to the fear that they could contain drugs. Now, what do we think of this? Are we with Caroline Duffy that it's affecting the soul of the country, or do we agree with Chris Grayling, who thinks that maybe it's just their right thing to do in an issue when drugs are so related? Now, who shall I go to first? Luke, I'll go to you first.
Well, let's get this debate in context, first of all. And Kieran, I'm pleased at the introduction that you've given, because that's an introduction that actually quite a lot of other media outlets have not given. They have not admitted that actually what this is it's a byproduct of a reform that is otherwise being introduced across the criminal justice system to try to standardise the current... the rewards and losses.
Incentives and earned privileges.
Thank you, the incentives and earned privilege system. It's an attempt to standardise that across all of the prisons, which has resulted in certain prisoners now, or in all prisoners now, being unable to receive those books from outside. This is not, as people like Caroline Duffy seems to have suggested, and as a lot of left-wing pressure groups have tried to promote, Chris Grayling saying reading's bad, we hate prisoners, therefore we shouldn't let prisoners read. Chris Grayling himself has said that he wants to encourage reading. In fact, one of the few decisions, the only decision he has made about books in prisons, is with regards to 50 Shades of Grey, where he said that he wanted that to be in a woman's prison because he felt that that might get them reading. He wants people to read. However, we can't deny the fact that if every prisoner was to receive a parcel, i.e. a book, every week, 4.5 million would be coming through the gates of the prison every year. That's not practical.
David.
No. Luke is right to point that this is not an argument about a rule about prisoners being prevented from getting books from the outside. This is about more general control over parcels that have been sent in. And it's interesting in a sense that this has come up, because it's only come up in the past month or so, despite the regulations affecting it being in law since last November. And so I've been quite interested myself to see how this scandal has developed. And I think it says a lot more about how we look at criminal justice in this country, because it is far and away one of the least worst things that the Ministry of Justice is doing. But it's still pretty terrible. The first thing to say is that the justification for this has been confused. Chris Grayling's relied on various different strands going forwards. The first thing he said was that this was about incentives and earned privileges. And the problem there being that the reason why that didn't satisfy his critics in any event was because under that incentives and earned privileges scheme, it's very, very difficult to get access to books. It's very difficult to buy them because the money that you get in prisons is so low. He then went on to talk about maintaining prison order, and he said that these book packages were being used to smuggle drugs into prison. Unfortunately for him, Steve Gillen, who is the head of the Prison Officer Association, which is not some left-wing trade union, but actually is quite a reactionary force and actually quite a pro-conservative force in terms of trade unions. Steve Gillen said that that's nonsense, that they've been handling these parcels for going on 20, 30 years, and that's a big issue. And then the third thing that he's had to say is that he's trying to enforce consistency across the prison estate. But really, that's just leaving people at the vicissitudes of the often underprivileged and often underused prison libraries. Not the most important thing out there, considering two-thirds of prisoners can't read. But I think this is indicative of the problem at the heart of the government's rehabilitation revolution.
I think you'll find, David, that it's a mix of all three of those, and you can't put your finger on one individual policy that's motivated this, because it has come as a part of all of that. We need consistency across the system, which means we can't see every prisoner having different rules. Somebody can't go from one part of the prison estate to the other side of the prison estate and have a different rule. There needs to be a consistent rule. Do we say that every prisoner is allowed one parcel per week? No, because that would mean that with the 85,000 prisoners we've got, there would be literally tens of thousands of packages that prison authorities would be needing to check every day across the system.
Ad hominem. I'm sorry, that is just absolute nonsense on stilts to say that because we've had this system in place where people can receive parcels from the outside world, and not every prisoner gets a parcel every day.
We have had the system to varying extents depending on whereabouts you are located in the prison. Mm-hmm. There needs to be, it can't be a, if you like, postcode lottery of where you are in prison. Prison should be a standardized system. You should have the same rights, privileges and everything else in one part of the prison just as you should another. That's obviously notwithstanding the differences between category A, category B, C, etc. But as far as being in one category of prison goes, that should be the only differences that you get. Actually, if you're in one prison, it shouldn't matter where it is. There should be the same rules that apply. And
but
part
why should
of that,
there be a race to the bottom? That's what's missing from that argument. Why should there be an argument that says no books whatsoever? Why shouldn't we be holding through places like Oakwood to task?
Because that was a question, Kieran. I'll be brief. Okay. Because if we do allow people, then it is going to place too much of a burden on the prison officers. It's going to be too much to look through everyone and trying to stop the drugs from coming through, trying to stop the other prohibited items from coming through in the parcels.
Okay, let's move on to someone
else. Right, on the drugs point, I think this is very important to address right from the outset. The drugs trade is probably one of the most innovative industries in the entire world. Drugs get through prisons through throwing tennis balls over fences that have drugs inside of them. Little mobile aeroplanes are flown over prisons. Yes, this is actually true, and they drop in drugs. I don't think someone is going to be quite as silly enough to put them in a parcel. So to say that it's to tackle drugs, I think it's inherently flawed. If they know that people aren't going to be checking the parcels,
if they know there are too many parcels so that people can't check it, then yeah, it's going to make sense for them to use it.
So does this come? So the suggestion I think you're making there is actually that this is more of a class thing, or trying to restrict the ability for prisoners to educate themselves.
If I'm honest, Kieran, I really don't know what the actual motive is. I mean, first of all, I think David is absolutely right. Prison libraries are underdeveloped as it is. There isn't enough variety in prison libraries, and so I think, you know, why should you stop books from going to prisons? I think the justification for drugs is inherently flawed. And, you know, as the director of the Howard League said, actually, Chris Grayling said that this system was fine a few months, years ago, and has suddenly said it's completely flawed. It's a complete U-turn, and there's absolutely no justification for it. It's a misdirected, flawed policy. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm. Barathi?
I agree with a lot of what it said. I mean, okay, if you're banning books on the basis that you might be able to smuggle drugs in books. Well, surely you can smuggle drugs and other things that you send into prison. And the other issue is this: the panel's talked
about.
Yeah,
lot. But sorry, no, that's where. And I hate to interrupt.
Let him make his point.
The other issue we've had so far is people have been that's come up on the panel is this whole idea of
homogeneity.
Homogeneity within the prison system. Well, the fact is, our justice system, our prison system, is nowhere near homogenous. And if you want to change it, this isn't where you start. You start from the top and you work your way down. So I think it's slightly misguided.
I think, if I can cut in, just while Joe's leaping over onto the other microphone, I think to answer the actual question, there is a huge class issue to why this whole debate has blown up into the fiasco it does. Because middle-class people do put a lot of point on books, do put a lot of point on the art of reading. And I think that's been used quite effectively by Francis Cook and the Howard League to try and challenge the rhetoric that the government uses at the moment. This is the first Conservative government, or one of the first anyway, that has been quite so blasé about using the term of rehabilitation. And it's a risky strategy because they're using it to mean things that patently for the practitioners, for the advocacy groups, it does not mean. They're talking about it in very broad senses of control, reducing reoffending, maintaining prison in order. And the Howard League have latched onto this idea of a book as a symbol of personal betterment, as a symbol of reaching out to all brave new worlds and vistas and things like that, that allows somebody to rehabilitate themselves. And I think that reflects a far broader malaise, and it's be very interesting to see what effect it has on the largely blind eye that's been turned to penal policy since the coalition came to power.
Joe.
Yeah, I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, I'm just jumping into this debate. It's all very interesting, but there was an article in the Spectator very recently that suggested, and I don't know whether this is true, that Chris Grayling is trying to get through a sort of, well, it won't be left wing, but a sort of rehabilitative reform for a part of the prison system. Now, I don't know what that is. And this article in particular suggested that this was sort of a carrot on a stick for the sort of right wing reactionary backbenchers. Now, I don't know whether that's true, but I'm just throwing that meat into the arena for these chaps to tackle.
Luke.
Well, I would say I don't think that helps in the sense that it confuses the debate even further, which, as we have already heard from others, is already pretty confused because we've got people. I mean, the point I was going to make earlier, Barathy, is that the parcels and books, it's to be seen as the same thing. And I think what David saw earlier on as being a good thing, i.e. the fact that the certain campaign groups such as the Howard League have adopted the book as this symbol, whilst he thinks that's a good thing, actually it's a bad thing because we're not just talking about books. We're not saying you can't send in books. We're saying you can't send in any sort of parcels. I think they were talking about, again, they were trying to appeal to the emotive side of people by saying that it meant children couldn't send in their drawings or whatever to the prisons. The point is, it's not about that specific item, and the emotional attachment to that specific item is being used, I'd say, rather unfairly to distract from the core of the policy, which is a thing that needs to be discussed here.
Just a quick point of clarification. I don't think I said that was necessarily a good thing. I think it's the most interesting thing about the debate. I think that's where the rhetoric's come from, this idea of challenging the rehabilitation revolution, which, frankly, Grayling has been stuck with since Clark. But I don't necessarily think it's a good thing. I think it does distract in very many ways. But okay. Seb?
I think, well, it's hard to say whether, because we don't really know if there is going to be some rehabilitative program Chris Grayling's trying to do, that this is kind of a cat on a stick for. Until I actually see more of a plan, I think I'm going to assume that there isn't. But certainly if he is trying to improve rehabilitation, this is one of the most counterproductive things to do, because reading in prisons is going to be one of the best things that can help people rehabilitate themselves. And I must say, I'm slightly cynical of Chris Grayling's record so far as Justice Secretary, that he is about to introduce some great rehabilitative reforms, but I hope he is.
Well, the other element of the debate that I haven't mentioned so far is this idea that books aren't provided for well in prisons. There are a number of letters that were sent to various newspapers last week from librarians within prisons who were quite frankly offended by some of the things that the people on this panel have furthered in the sense of claiming there are inadequate resources for books in prisons. At the moment, the books in prisons provide just the same kind of service that you could expect from a local library in terms of the number of books that are on offer. In addition, prisons are able to purchase, using the money that they can earn as part of the incentive scheme, the money that they can get, to buy other books on Amazon. They can get those sorts of things that they want coming into the prison system already. I absolutely agree that books are something that should be encouraged, and that reading is something that should be encouraged because of the reasons that have been mentioned. You know, it does encourage prisoners to get a different perspective, maybe provide some motivation and some inspiration for them. But the way that it's done can't be done in a way that leaves them vulnerable to the importing of drugs and other kinds of items into prisons. And that is the crux of this policy.
Well, again, they've been doing it for 20, 30 years, and the Prison Officers Association doesn't have a problem with it. The point about books, though, buying, getting them from libraries, yes, prison libraries exist. Yes, they're doing the best job that they can, but they're facing the same cuts as everybody else. They're facing the same problem of limited space within prisons and limited budgets to buy and maintain book stocks, particularly people who want to read in foreign languages, including Welsh, for the purposes of the prison system in England and Wales. That's a major blow to their ability to read while they're in prison. And I think the sheer pettiness of this idea that you can buy a book with your own money, you can send money in, Jeremy Wright, the prisons minister, has said, for people to buy these books, but you can't send them themselves, just makes a complete nonsense of this. And I think the best thing Grayling could possibly have done was actually to say, yeah, okay, you're right, we'll make an exception, to get rid of this broad middle class misplaced idea that books are Jesus.
Yes, another kind of linked point is that while, yeah, their books are available in libraries, they do tend, many cases are in fact understocked. And one of the major problems with prisoners, they do have to buy books themselves. And although they can work in the prison to get money, this has to go for basic treats and also basic things like sanitary goods, their shampoo, basic goods.
Yeah, just like everyone else in society, just to say, this isn't an exception. Okay. The prisoners are the only people that need to pay for their essential items.
Limit to the amount of income that prisoners can earn by their jobs in prison, so they can't earn any more and enough to buy many books.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid that's all we have time for on this week's Big Picture. Thank you to all the panellists. Thank you to all of you at home who got involved. And don't forget to join us next Wednesday, 6 o'clock, for our final show of the term, where Joe will be sitting in the hot seat.